Hello and welcome to Lost Steps with me, Malcolm Hopkins, coming to you courtesy of Resonance FM. If you've missed any of our previous episodes or would like any background information on this or any of our other programmes, please access our website, loststeps.org. And today I'm pleased to be joined by the photographer Paul Trevor, and we'll be talking about the East Ender Archive. Well, welcome to Lost Steps, Paul.
Thanks for inviting me.
Right, first of all, can I take you back in time? What was it that attracted you to photography? Did you have any heroes? Why photography as a medium?
I think my dad's pictures were always he had a photo album. They always fascinated me. I couldn't even articulate to anybody, not to him or to, how wonderful I thought they were. He basically took these black. My dad was very young during the Second World War. He volunteered, but he was too young to serve. So he was basically training, and the training was in Canada, or then he had to do some service in Egypt and whatever. So in fact, he never killed anybody during the war, but he took a lot of photographs of where he was, and then he very carefully, you know, these photographs were small ones with serrated edges, and he placed them in an album. And they told me a story about my dad. He didn't, you know, and I just thought, God, this is amazing. And his girlfriends and then my mum and just this continuous life in images. And that really was I didn't think about being a photographer. I actually trained to be an accountant.
So did you have any formal training in photography at all?
I never did a full course. I tried to do a one-day course, but I got kicked off that.
Time-wise, when did you start taking photographs? What sort of period are we talking about?
I picked up the camera. My uncle gave me a camera when I was about 13. That was great. It was called an Ilford Sportsman because that's where where I grew up, in Ilford, Essex. And of course, I later discovered Ilford photographic paper. That was quite another kind of bit of serendipity. But I think it was on a hitchhiking trip in the early 72, this American girl showed me her camera and explained it was a Pentax, and I was so impressed by the look of it and the lesson she gave me, you know, about, and I realized how easy it was. It's just three things. You have to focus, you have to get the exposure right, and you do that with a shutter speed and the aperture, and that's it. It's really, really, really simple, and it's just a box and control the amount of light that comes on the film. So I got it.
Okay, so you start off there. How does the East End come into it? What was the attraction of the East End?
Okay, I left school. I was 15. I had some O levels, and I wanted to be. I didn't really want to be. I didn't know what, but I was trained to be a chartered accountant, and I went off to work in an accountant's office. And I did that, and you know, an article clerk, you sign, it's kind of a bit of slavery, you sign this thing, a document to say you will work almost like a slave. In the old days, you didn't get paid, the parents had to pay the accountant, your principal, for the arcane knowledge, the dark secrets of the profession, whatever. I was getting £9 a fortnight, so it wasn't even worth their while paying you weekly. It was £9 a fortnight. And you do donkey work. And somewhere along the line, one day I'm standing in the tube, hanging on like everybody else, like a sardine with my sandwiches and the briefcase. And I thought, if you had the choice to do whatever you want to do, you had a wish that could be fulfilled, what would you want to be? What would you want to do? And the answer that came back was a filmmaker. I had no idea anything about films, no connection with filmmakers, no relatives or friends or anything. It's just that. And I thought, okay, you got to start finding out about film. I went to the library and I got a little book about the camera, film camera, and I then even found a little group of amateur people. It was hysterical. We were all so bad, and we were entering these competitions for amateurs. Incredible. But, you know, the first day they said to me, what do you do? And I said, I just got this book on the Bolex camera. And I said, well, I can do the camera. They said, great, we need someone. But I soon realized, you know, I needed to get to grips with it. So I found in those days there's no courses really, but I went to Regent Street Polytechnic where the part of their visual thingy, I don't know, it was a poly, so maybe they didn't do a degrees, but course included filmmaking. And I went there and I said, can I do film here? And they said, we suggest you get a camera, take some pictures, come back next year, show us you've got some ability, and also get some A-levels. So I like one of them. I like the one suggestion. But in the process of doing the photo, and, you know, I then got embarked on trying to get a camera and all the rest of it. The first camera, I borrowed the lens from my dad. I then, because I'd been used to working with other people collaboratively on projects, I then asked the other students that I met, do you want to work in be part of a group? And we met one day in my flat and we decided we were going to do a just to see if we could work. It didn't matter. There was no, we were going to take a whole load of pictures on exit signs and then come back in a couple of weeks and see what we made of them. We became known as the Exit Photography Group. But actually, before we could do that, I somehow saw some pictures. Somebody told me about Wapping. It seemed very atmospheric. And for the next 3 weekends, we all went down to Wapping, which was like in London, but isolated. It was, you had to go over a bridge. It was like a little island and very, very different kind of atmosphere because the docks had closed, it was in decline, and it was also like a sink estate for all kinds of problem families. But it was also had a lot of charm. So anyway, we did all these pictures, gave away, we all helped each other, gave away a lot of prints, and then they said to us, you know, we have a festival. Every year we have the E1 Festival. Why don't you show the pictures at the E1? And we had the first open-air photo exhibition and the Bigland Green, and one of the guys worked at London Airport. He bought all this tarpaulin, plastic sheet in case it rained. It was a huge success. And then they raised the money to do a little booklet. So I know it's a long story, but the thing is that that little booklet seemed to, in some people's eyes, establish us as a group, a functioning group of photographers, and we were commissioned to do this bigger inner city studies. That's how it came about. They said, you know, here's the money. Not a lot of money. We were living on like 25 quid a week, which was the national average wage at the time. But they said, take the pictures for 6 weeks and then deliver them. So 6 months, sorry. We did that for 6 months. We're not realizing it would then take another 6 months to do the bloody editing. So finally, they did give us the money for the further 6 months. And having done the edit, having processed everything, seen what we had, we then understood what we didn't have. And this was quite a moment, you know? And we said to them, listen, it's a study. There's gaps. We've got to fill those gaps. And they said, yeah, okay, but not with our money. Bye-bye. So then the problem was raising the money. So we would stop, earn some money, save it for the next, it just dragged on. But we promised them we will deliver a book at the end, and we did. But it did take 6 years from the beginning, not 6 months. I enrolled at the John Cass School of Art, which was like anybody could. And I did, in fact, they didn't offer photography. So I did sculpture, ceramics, and life drawing. And by chance, I saw, walking past the corridor, I saw an enlarger. And I inquired, and it was the technician's enlarger who was servicing the whole of the building and others. And he said, yeah, okay, you can try and do things. And he's a dear friend to this day, that guy. He's Mick Williamson, he was the technician, but now runs the whole photography department. A unique character, amazing guy. So one lunchtime, when I had this little group, I went for a walk to look for a place to have our little office, to set up our headquarters for this project. We needed someplace. And Brick Lane was at the end of, was right next to it. It was no, and that was the cheapest place that we, but it was so grim. We thought, no, this is too, it's dire here. Let's try and look for somewhere else. And having not found anything, we went back and there it was, still available. And we went, okay, this is it. We stay here.
So a lot of it was almost serendipity.
Oh, completely. Nothing planned.
Nothing planned.
And in fact, no one was going to live there. I was living in Brixton, staying with a friend in Brixton. And Diane, she and her husband split up. So they sold the house. And so I temporarily moved in the back room of this, our darkroom place in Brick Lane. And slowly became, I was the caretaker and then the minder and then kind of, eventually that was the base for all of us. And I had the room at the back to sleep in.
Okay, so you've set up in Brick Lane. What sort of year are we talking about here?
We set up in Brick Lane in 1974.
And what was your feeling of the area at the time?
It was Dickensian. It was seriously, seriously run down. Nobody in their right minds would I mean, it was very, I've got some photographs of it, very, very different to what it is now. And in a way, it fulfilled the classic role. You know, the poor migrants would come in, the people, the transitory people. So at that time, I know the history well now. The Irish came. Well, before the Irish, you had the Huguenots escaping religious persecution. And then you had the Irish, then you had the Jewish, and now you've got the Bengalis. So it always fulfilled that thing that it was always outside the city wall. People forget Brick Lane was, and the brewery in Brick Lane were the two guilds that couldn't operate inside the city wall. And Aldgate was the Elder's Gate, was one of the gates of the city. They couldn't operate inside because of the smell. Noxious gases, or whatever it was called, noxious. So Brick Lane was where you had the brewery, you had the brickworks, and you had the people who couldn't afford to be on the other side of the wall. But they served, they were within walking distance, they could walk into the city. And traditionally, you know, rundown, we'd say deprived area, but also in this case, it was so neglected, it was so grim. And then all that happened over the next 15 years, I would say, is just they kept knocking down more and more and more. And I've got some pictures where there's just nothing but corrugated sheets, nothing, just the whole area flattened. And then those corrugated sheets would be knocked down because the gypsies would arrive and set up a camp. So it was a very neglecting and very bleak in winter. It was like, God, this is unbelievable, because you could see the city of London just about a mile away, the Westminster Tower, all that money, all that power. Oh, and these people living in something that looks like it's a movie set.
How did people respond when you photographed them? Were they suspicious? Were they concerned? Or have you ever had any problems about when you photographed people?
Well, you know, the stuff I did in Brick Lane, nobody asked me to do it. Nobody paid me to do it. I did it because I wanted to do it. And I did it. I carried this little camera over my shoulder all the time. There wasn't a project. It was just I was seeing things. That interest, whatever interests me, I took a picture. Now, at the beginning, people probably thought, well, who's this weird guy? But within a very short period of time, that became my role. And in fact, the occasional times when I'd be walking down without a camera, they'd say, Paul, where's your camera? So it was I became the guy that takes the pictures. And I wasn't an outsider. It's all from the inside. You know, I call it the East Ender archive because this is one of the East End. I'm one of the East Enders. It's not the East End archive. It's the East Ender archive. It's very much from the inside. And I told you about my dad showing me these pictures over a period of time. Photography is great because it can capture one tiny fraction of an instant, but it can also do a decades. And I had the ambition, well, not really ambition, I just understood that if you keep going, keep doing it, there will be a narrative. That's what my dad's album showed me. There was a narrative. So I just kept going. And I did it, you know, 25 years.
I mean, what were the most noticeable changes, if any, over that period of 25 years?
Oh, the fabric of the place. You know, the buildings gone, new buildings up, the atmosphere. And of course, slowly, slowly, when the brewery went and the market went, these are vast. I mean, the brewery was like a little city, if you know the story of the brewery. Literally like a massive two or three blocks. The market stopped first and was relocated, very much like Covent Gardens was relocated. And then the brewery was emptied out and maybe shut, and maybe because it was, there was a buyout with Metropolitan, you know, property company. And actually, apparently, one guy bought the whole thing. I think he's an Israeli guy. But they have, apparently, their philosophy is phenomenally good. They're very kind, they've got a humanitarian streak about them as property people. And the artists were the first, as usual, to come in. So it became really the new West End very soon. I mean, with it became the creative hub. You got designers, you got fashion, you got music, all in this one building. And these are very different type of people to the Bengali community. That was quite striking. You got the Bengalis, it was quite, you know, I would say more traditional. And then you've got these kind of cutting edge characters. And they weren't really, you didn't see intermingling, you didn't see a kind of integration. Although, you know, you got some musicians, always do. So you got some great movements in terms of music and some great bands, Asian bands, and fusing with more modern rhythms and so on. So now it's probably the most amazing, it's the most cosmopolitan place in London. It's an amazing, vibrant place. I mean, it's, for me, it knocks me out when I see it. When I was walking down, you know, then in the 70s, it was dark and dangerous. I never felt frightened, but, you know, to outside, it looked like not a very nice place to be living in.
So how many photographs of the East End do you think you've taken?
Well, I made a mistake because I, in the project to try and create the archive, I did it with the London Metropolitan University. And they said, and all the stuff at that point was in storage. And they said to me, well, how many negatives are we talking about? And I said, let me think. And I guessed roughly 50,000. And then when it came to actually doing it, it turned out it was 120,000. So I've pressed that shot 120,000 times at least. Unfortunately, not all the pictures are that good.
I mean, at that period, there was a lot of racial tension. The NF were active.
Yeah. Well, that marked an amazing moment because what happened there is the new generation of Bengalis emerged, the young kids who weren't going to... They were British born, they were Londoners, and they weren't... Their attitude was completely different to their parents, who were always like meek and mild, stay out of trouble, low profile. They organised, they were not having it. The East Ender archive project was my own personal thing. But suddenly for that period, because they all knew me, they said, Paul, we're doing this, we're going to... They kind of insisted that I come along and document it. So for that, there was a period of a year and a half, 2 years, an amazing amount, an explosion of events. And when the National Front, because it began really in 1978 when a young guy, Al-Tabali, who was just a garment worker going home, was stabbed in the neck, killed. Actually, there were three people killed on the streets of London, one in Hackney. So in the East End, three people were killed that year. And they'd had enough. And they didn't feel the police were taking them seriously. They started to organize. And then as you know, the Anti-Nazi League started to form this. So all these connections were being made. And I really felt my role had changed as I became a kind of reporter, photojournalist for that period. And I'm really been trying for now for 3 years to do a book about that period, having great difficulty because we want the people who were there to give the first-hand account, to do the interviews. And, you know, people are dying because we're talking about a long time ago. I've got in-depth series of pictures about that time from the archive. So that's one of the books I'm doing. I'm actually excavating the archive, and there will be 7 books in all covering different themes. And that one is called Brick Lane 1978, The Turning Point.
That's actually quite interesting, because one of the things I was thinking is you can not only look at the archives in terms of time, but you can go and look at themes. Did the V&A do something about childhood? Did they take out an extract, series of photographs, and do a thing about childhood?
Ah, yeah, in the Museum of Childhood in Bethnal Green Road. Yeah, they contacted me and we did. Yeah, it was the first effort, 20 images from the archive. There are loads. I'm going to do a book just on childhood. And that was like a preview, as it were, 20 pictures of that from that era. And as we were talking earlier, nowadays it's a completely, it's a very fraught issue, photographing kids, you know.
I mean, that's one thing that I assume must have changed, because looking at some of your photographs from the early period, and dare I suggest photographs that people, you know, parents took, they're pretty candid. I think people would think perhaps twice about producing those now. I mean, do you find that limiting on your activities?
Oh, God. I mean, listen, I've said this many times, and I don't mind repeating it. This is the first generation of kids in 150 years that are not being photographed in the way that they have over the last 150 years. We're living through a rather weird, paranoid period. I don't think it'll last, but I think we've got to get over it, and we've got to get the pictures that each generation deserves. The photographers are not, and the photographers that do are being given a terrible time. And you've got to register with this, you know, you've got to be cleared by the police and social workers. And imagine Cartier-Bresson getting permission before taking a photograph. I mean, we would have lost a very rich vein in the world of photography.
And also street life.
Absolutely. Photographers aren't weird people. You know these groups at the moment. You know, I'm a photographer, not a terrorist. The photographic culture is so important. It's actually the dominant culture of our time, and to inhibit it in any way is stupid, and that's what's happening. And you know, students are being advised, get permission first. Well, I mean, that's ludicrous. But they have to do it. All the libraries, will not, you know, you need a model release form. Imagine going up, saying, could you mind signing this? And then I'll do the picture that I just saw, two minutes ago, which was great, and now it's gone forever.
See, that's actually quite interesting, because, I mean, that would suggest that something has changed quite drastically since you started in the activities, where you felt free, you could just go out and shoot.
Absolutely.
Whatever.
And so did all the other photographers throughout time. You could, listen, in the streets, in the public place, nobody has privacy. You know, if you want to, I mean, people going on a demo can't protest because they're out there. It's a public domain. It's a public area. I always respect people. You know, I've taken photographs, and my first concern is to get the image. And there are times when I've got time to consider later and I decide not to publish. That's a separate issue. But the right to make the image exist is there. Now, if you intrude into someone's private space, you know, obviously, it depends. But my attitude, I want to respect them. You do it with goodwill. And normally I show them the picture. I said that I'm intending to use this just to get an idea if they have any objections. But sometimes I've withheld because I felt relatives and that person would actually... Their self-image wouldn't be enhanced or helped in any way.
So you self-censor?
A few occasions I've done that for various reasons, yeah. For example, you know, somebody who's completely, you know, an alcoholic who's spewing all over themselves. And I've been there and photographed this bit, you know, and then decided, well, it's an amazingly powerful image, but I'm not going to use it ever.
When you were doing the archive, were you particularly conscious of that? Because this is something that's going to be publicly available. When you were looking at those images, were you even more conscious of that, if you see what I mean?
Well, it's very interesting. I'm now in charge of the archive, and I'm going to do a series of books. And that's great, because I now know the archive far better. I mean, the problem was it was such a lot of images. The digital technology came around, saved my life in a way. It was a mountain of stuff, and how do you even begin to come to grips with it? Actually, now there's software that allows you to create what we call sort of virtual sets. So you can play about with them very, very easily and very rapidly. And that's aided me. I mean, I don't think I could have done these series of themes, extracted them, without this software. So it's made my life really easy.
Okay, perhaps we better bring it up to date as time's going to be running out shortly. So what current projects are you working on? And can people see your photographs anywhere at the moment?
Well, I'm hoping very soon. I should be more together. I'm one of these people. You know, how some people are very good at business and others are not at all. And I'm in the latter camp, not very good in that respect. I'm hoping to be able to make the EastEnder archive images available. Because of so much, what I've decided to do is to start a blog very soon, probably in the next 2 or 3 weeks, and put up one picture every day or every week, maybe every week, one new picture. So that will keep me going for at least 10 years, right? And there, so that will be like a blog. Hopefully on my website, I try and create a link by theme or by whatever, so people can see, let's say, 500 images that I've selected that represents the work. I think 500 is pretty substantial. So that's my target with the EastEnder stuff. I've, of course, done lots of other stuff. You know, I've published, I think I did one of the first photo books online. It's called The Photomo Blues. It was published in 1996. It's still online somewhere. I did it to try and teach myself, find out about the new technology, as it were. But if they want to see it, then it's on the Ellipsis website. Ellipsis, you know, with a dot, dot, dot. Somewhere there, if they go and they'll see the Photomo Blues, and it's actually a combination of images and text, and it was kind of an experimental thing, and I'm very proud of it, but that's kind of available in the way that the EastEnder Archive isn't. So if people want to see that.
Can people access the EastEnder Archive at the moment?
Well, the EastEnder Archive actually at the moment is only what the work that was done with the London Metropolitan University. And all universities who do these kind of projects, to get the funding and to get the approval, actually have to put it on another website where they do quality control. And that's called VADS, V-A-D-S, the Visual Arts Data Service. When you go there, you'll see loads of collections, all kinds from all over the place. And one of them is the London Metropolitan Paul Trevor collection. Some very, very significant images, like I was talking about, the issue of the race issue and others, are missing. So that's unfortunate, but it will be sorted out.
Right. Well, I'm regretfully we're running out of time. As I said previously, if you want to get any background information on this program or any others, please access our website, loststeps.org. How can people contact you, and how can they read your blog?
Okay. If they go to paultrevor.com, they can contact me there. At the moment, it just says this website is under reconstruction. I'm going to try and sort something out, you know, in the next month.
Well, we'll hold you to that, Paul.
Some of the pictures are from the EastEnder Archive are currently in the exhibition at the Museum of London. They have a number of work prints of mine, and they got in the 1980s, late 80s. And they're showing these little work prints. They're not fine prints, they're small, but they've put some up. And, you know, I'm one of, you know, many Londoners, London photographers in that exhibition. It's a historical exhibition, you know, it's 1860 yeah. to 2000. So it's kind of historical.
Well, thanks very much, Paul, for managing to fit us in your busy schedule. I know you've got to rush off now and disappear, but thanks very much. Thank you.
Thanks very much.